As you can see before you on the screen this evening, our title for our lesson is Argument from Complexity. But for those of you that have been here all week, it's the same argument we've been making from the beginning. It's the argument from design. And I thought this evening, as we have each time, we'll begin with a passage of Scripture. So turn with me to Psalm 139 as a beginning place this evening. Psalm 139. Another of the great passages of Scripture that testifies of God's creative power. So let's look beginning in verse 13. You have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me when as yet there were none of them. The writer, of course, in that passage is proclaiming that God knew us before we were ever born, and that we have been fashioned by him as his creation. And so the Bible clearly teaches, doesn't it, that God is the author of those of us who are humans. That's what this is particularly talking about. And we are wonderfully made. Well, let's look also at the other passage we've been examining every evening, because it's the theme passage for the whole week, Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, which says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." One of my goals in this series of lessons is to overwhelm us with the testimony of things that are made, which testify of a grand and glorious Maker who has intelligence beyond what we can imagine, power and divinity, all of which are testified from the things that we observe in the natural world. Now, I've told you I'm prejudiced. I'm prejudiced toward chemistry, and thus my talks focus mainly on that general theme. And it's because we have been so blessed in the last 50 years to have unfolded to us the magnificence of God's wonderfully created organisms in a way we never had before. So I want to do that again with you tonight. We turn now to God's other book, the testimony of his natural world. As we've said before in this series, there are only two basic views for how you explain how we got here. One is that we got here by natural causes. Evolution claims you can explain it all by reductionism. Here's what they mean by that. Complex organs arose from simpler things by small steps, by natural causes. Anything can be broken down, Dawkins would say, or Darwin would say, into small steps. And each of those small steps is very reasonable. And surely nature could have done those small steps. And when you add those up over a long enough period of time, you get something that's very complicated, but really it took place by small steps over long periods of time. That's the idea. And I can tell you that's the essence of Darwin's theory of natural selection. So that's one answer to this question. A second one is that they had to be designed. These things were created. The proponents of intelligent design say that complex organs could not have arisen without intelligence acting upon nature. You cannot reduce the complexity that we see to simple steps which add up to produce complex things. No, intelligence was required. So those are the two issues. And tonight, as we have before, we're going to look at some evidence from the natural world. Evidence, facts of nature that we've been able to uncover. Then we're going to ask ourselves, which is more reasonable, natural causes or intelligent design? And you can answer that for yourself after you've investigated the evidence. So let's look at the evidence tonight. And let's let Darwin talk about this question. If I can make it go forward, there we go. Here's what Darwin said about complex organs, and let me show you the book. Darwin's On the Origin of Species, first published in 1859. I would say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this book, in my opinion, has had more impact on human beings' worldview than any other book other than this one. It has literally taken over academia, as people have swallowed the notion that this is a natural explanation for all that we see. In this book, I respect the way Darwin approaches the subject. If you haven't read this book and you're interested in this topic at all, this is where you should begin. I won't ask you to raise your hands to ask how many folks have read this book. My experience in an audience like this is there are usually about 2 or 3 out of 150. Most folks have never read it. It's worth reading. And let me tell you one reason why. Darwin explains what's wrong with his theory over and over again. And then he proceeds to explain how he can explain it away anyway. But at least he gives you some of the problems with regard to his theory. So read with me this quote directly from that book. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. That is the essence of what Darwin was saying in his book. Anything you examine, any complex organ, if you can break it down into little, small, successive steps, you can explain it by natural selection. He said, if you can find one where that could not have happened, then my theory absolutely breaks down. Now, I firmly believe that if Darwin were alive today in the 21st century, and he knew what I'm about to present to you this evening, he would never have come up with this theory in the first place. I think he was that honest. Had he seen what was down inside and underneath, I think he would have known better. Lots of other folks don't seem to get it. So, is there such an organ? Well, let me show you a test for this thing. Here's the second book I'm introducing to you tonight. It's called Darwin's Black Box, written by Michael Behe, a biochemist. And he calls it Darwin's Black Box because here's what he says. Most of what's discussed in this book, Darwin had no clue about. To him, it was just a black box. The structure and the chemistry of the cell to Darwin was a black box. So Behe says, in some senses, he could be forgiven for coming up with his theory. But had he seen what was down inside that black box, it would have been a different story. And at the beginning of that book, he gives this illustration. Suppose you had a front yard here. This is your front yard. By the way, you need to take care of your front yard. It doesn't look very good. And you had a ditch running around through it here, and you found somebody over here on this side in your yard, and you ask him, how'd you get in my front yard? And he says, well, I just jumped over the ditch. Probably you'd say, well, that's probably how you got here. Why don't you leave the same way you came? What if the ditch were that big? And by the way, your yard's looking really bad over here. What if the ditch were this big? And he says, oh, I just jumped over the ditch. Well, maybe that's about a 5-foot ditch. You could probably take a running start and jump over that. What if the ditch were that big, about 13 feet across? And he says, I just jumped over the ditch to get to your yard. You'd probably say, I want to see that. Show me you can do that. And what if it were this ditch? And here's your yard over here, and he was over here, and he says, I just jumped over that ditch. Well, that begins to stretch the imagination, doesn't it? But he's kind of a smart guy, and he said, well, look, I didn't take that jump all in one leap. I jumped from here to a butte, and then to this butte, and then to that butte, and then to that butte, and then to that one, and to that one, and 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 finally I got over here. And you look out there, and you say, I don't see all those buttes. He said, well, after I jumped off them, they disappeared. You'd probably change the subject. because that becomes unbelievable. And that provides a good basis for our discussion this evening, ladies and gentlemen, because what you're going to find out is the things that Darwin did not know when he wrote his book that we have uncovered since the 1850s have presented grand canyons at every stage of the way. What Darwin thought was just a little 4-foot jump has become a grand canyon everywhere you look. So that's why I like that illustration, and we'll come back to it again and again. So let's talk about a complex organ. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed that couldn't have been formed by little tiny steps adding up over time. Well, how about this one? How about your eye? Could that have been formed by small steps over long periods of time? Here's what Darwin said about it. Because he talked about the eye in his book in the 1850s. To suppose that the eye, with all of its inimitable contrivances, don't you like that? They used to talk pretty. With all of its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus for different distances, everybody in this audience knows, do you not, that your eye automatically focuses for things that are up close and things that are at distance? Automatically. Darwin knew about that. And for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberrations, your eye automatically makes corrections for certain disformities on your cornea. And Darwin knew about that. That this could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. And I say, amen. That does seem absurd. But after saying that, Darwin proceeds to tell you why he still believes it did happen by natural selection. And here's what he says. Yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist. So his first argument is this. Can you find in nature lots of different kinds of eyes? Some of them very simple, and some of them very complex? Do you know the answer to that? The answer is yes, you can. And could you argue that each of those kinds of eyes was some benefit to the organ or the thing that possessed it? I think you could. That's his first argument. Then he says, if further the eye does vary ever so slightly, and the variations be inherited. Would you agree with that? That eyes vary naturally? Well, some of you are wearing glasses in here and some of you aren't. I will confess to you, I'm wearing contacts and I still have to wear glasses on top of that. Thank you, Mom and Dad. So do eyes vary from person to person? And is that variation inherited? Absolutely it is. That's his second argument, which is certainly the case, he says. And if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, could you argue that some changes in eyes make better use for some animals? I think you could argue that. Then he says, the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, can hardly be considered real. So Darwin's argument was, you can form eyes by little small steps of different types of eyes over time. And therefore your eye could have come about that way. Now I want to say something to everyone. I've heard folks who believe in God say that Darwin's book and his idea is so stupid that no human being should ever even think about it. And I'm telling you, there's some validity to Darwin's argument. I think Darwin explains very well limited change within distinct limits. What he doesn't explain is how something as complex as an eye came about, or how elephants, human beings, giraffes, and all other kinds of creatures were produced by natural causes from single-celled organisms. That he doesn't explain. But there is some truth to what he says. So don't throw all of it out with the notion that there's nothing about it that's valid. Let me try to explain this argument a little better. Do you know jellyfish have eyes? They do. Up here on the top of this surface, there's a photoreceptive cell, or just a piece of an eye, just the simplest type of an eye. Really, basically, all that does is it reacts to light that hits it, and it allows the jellyfish to turn way or one way or another depending on how the light hits it. That's about all it is. So if you were in Darwin's class in the 1850s, here's what he'd say to you, class. He'd say, jellyfish have simple eyes. They are so simple that surely you can believe that the first jellyfish eye came about by natural causes. All it is a light-sensitive spot. I mean, isn't that believable? That's a tiny step. And maybe that's how all eyes began, by the simplest kind of an eye. The marine limpet also has eyes, but they're cupped. Let me explain to you the difference, class. In a marine limpet, basically the eye is cupped, and at the bottom of that cup is the light-sensitive spot. So you've gone from a light-sensitive spot on the jellyfish to a light-sensitive spot in a cup. Now, is that hard to imagine that nature could have done that? You already had a light-sensitive spot. All you had to do was produce a cup somehow by natural variation. Would there be any advantage to an organism to have an eye that had a cup with a light-sensitive spot at the bottom? Yes, there would, because it helps direct the light to the light-sensitive spot. You see that? So Darwin would argue, maybe the marine limpet's eye is the next type of eye in the process of evolution of a complex eye. Tiny steps, which are adding up. I told you that one of my objects in this series is to make you think like an evolutionist thinks. I think it's a valuable exercise. Snails also have eyes. And if you were in my class in Darwin's day, I would say to you, if I were Darwin, look, a snail's eye looks like this, class. It's cupped, and it has the light-sensitive spot at the bottom of that cup, and across the top is a very thin film. That's it. Well, can't you believe, class, that that film could have just developed by natural changes over time? So now you've got a cupped eye with a film over the top, kind of like a lens. Very simple. Nature could have done that, he would argue. And then he would say, through a process of stages, maybe the fruit fly's compound eye, maybe the honeybee's got three different kinds of eyes, and maybe the eagle's eye, and maybe eventually our eye over time evolved by small stages over long periods of time, to the point that we now have complex eyes. That's the argument. And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that argument has sufficient, at least logic to it, that lots of people have bought in. And what I'm happy to tell you tonight is that what Darwin thought was simple steps have each become a Grand Canyon. Darwin said, how a nerve comes to be sensitive to light hardly concerns us any more than how life itself first originated. Well, I would say, what? That's a pretty important question. And may I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, if we had time to do it tonight, I would love to look at you, with you, at the chemistry of the jellyfish eye, which is just a light-sensitive spot. To Darwin, I'm not worried about how a nerve became sensitive to light. That's no big deal. That's like just a little old 4-foot jump. And I'm telling you, if you study the chemistry of a light-sensitive spot, you're going to find out it's a Grand Canyon that the evolutionist needs to explain. As are each of those stages that he talked about as if it was something really simple, just leap over a little ditch. No, beloved, you better leap over the Grand Canyon to get there. Dawkins makes the same argument in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which I read to you from the first night. Vision that is 5% is as good as yours or mine is very much worth having in comparison to no vision at all. So is 1% vision better than total blindness? 6% is better than 5, 7 better than 6, and so on up the series. You see, the ultimate reductionist. You can get 1% vision, then 2% vision, then 3%. You know the problem with that? How do you know you're going to get any vision at all with 1%? And the fact is, we know very well you won't get any vision at all if all you have is 1%. So no, it's not better. And Dawkins is as wrong as he can be. So, here's the book I presented to you, Darwin's Black Box, and it'll give you much more information than I can give you tonight, but I want to share with you just a few things from this book to show you the grand canyons that must be leaped to explain life by the Darwinian explanation. It doesn't work. So let's look at the eye and its biochemistry. We're going to look at our eye tonight because I think you're more interested in that than anything else. Well, see, this diagram of the eye was well known in Darwin's day. They had dissected eyes for years. So they knew all these different parts. Here's the cornea and the lens and the iris, and here's the vitreous body. For those of you that are as old as I am, you can blink your eyes and don't you get these little floaters going across? I see some floaters right now. They're floating around in that vitreous body there. You see right here along the back edge of this eye is this kind of a purple-colored layer that's called the retina. It's at the back of your eyeball, and we know very well, as did Darwin, by the way, that that's where the light signals are received, and then from that retina, the signals are sent down through the optic nerve to the brain, where your body in its brain interprets that signal and translates it into three-dimensional color pictures. And we're not even talking about what happens in the brain tonight. We're talking about the eyeball. But again, may I offer my apology to every nerve signal that's sent through the optic nerve for not telling you more about this. Because the chemistry that takes place inside your brain to convert that signal into three-dimensional color sight is incredible. But see, we know much more than this today. We can get down and see that neural layer that's in the retina. There's a picture of it magnified considerably. And I don't know how well you can read it, but here are the nucleus of the rods and the cones and the bipolar neurons and the ganglion cells. Those are the basic makeup of that little thin layer, magnified. But ladies and gentlemen, we can do much better than that. You see this? This is another magnification of the rods and the cones, magnified several more times relative to this one. And then we can take one of those rod cones and watch. Here's a magnification of one of those human rod cells. See its nucleus and the Golgi bodies and the mitochondria and the microtubules. There's the nucleus. Remember we talked about all this last night? I know you all remember every bit of this. This is a very specialized cell, and you see up here there's a bunch of discs inside that cell. Well, we can magnify that piece considerably. You see this piece right here? That's that tiny piece right there magnified again. This is 0.5 micrometers, and it's magnified. So here are all those disks. Here are the mitochondrion blown up, the microtubules. But can you see how much better we can see what's going on inside there? and then take a little small piece of these discs up here, and it's been blown up again, so that this is what those discs look like. And across from them is the plasma membrane, and in here is the space where lots of things take place which allow you to see. And we know exactly what's happening in there. So for the next few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, I need to do a little chemistry with you. Now, you can check out if you want to, but I don't want to skip this, because here's what I want. I know you're not going to remember this stuff. Here's what I want. I want you to be impressed with what's happening every time you see something. Down inside at the chemical level, Darwin had no clue about that. As I said, he can almost be forgiven for thinking that maybe this was just a small step. Folks, this is a Grand Canyon. Let's take a look. We're going to take a look at what's happening right here, which is in part of that little old disc right there, which is part of this whole system of rod cones, and you think your way back through, it's in the retina. So there it is. Here are these discs, and here's the chemistry that's happening, and I don't have this memorized, so I'm going to read it to you. Again, when you read this book, he's got the chemistry parts marked off with little boxes so you can skip it. You can still get the point. When light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis-retinal, which rearranges within picoseconds to trans-retinal. You know how long a picosecond is, ladies and gentlemen? A picosecond is the time it takes light to cross over one hair. You know how fast light travels? 186,000 miles per second. Wonder how long it would take light to cross over one hair. That's a picosecond. The stuff I'm going to be telling you about in this chemical reaction takes place in picoseconds. That's fast. All right, let me get my pointer back here. So what you now have is you've got 11-cis retinal that in a picosecond has been changed in its shape to a retinal molecule that forces a change in the shape of the protein rhodopsin. You see rhodopsin right here? When the photon strikes, one of the first things that happens is rhodopsin changes shape. The protein's metamorphosis alters its behavior. Now it's called rhodopsin 2, metarhodopsin 2. The protein sticks to another protein called transducin, right there. This protein sticks to that one. Before bumping into metarhodopsin 2, transducin had tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when the transducin interacts with GDP, the GDP falls off, a part of it falls off, and the molecule GTP binds. You see it right there? The GTP binds to the transducin, which bound to the rhodopsin. You with me so far? The GTP transducin metarhodopsin 2 now binds to a protein called phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase now combines with all of these guys into a big conglomerate. Located on the inner membrane of the cell when attached to the metarhodopsin 2 and its entourage, the phosphodiesterase acquires a chemical ability to cut a molecule called cGMP right here and make it into 5-GMP. It cuts that molecule. Do you see over here there's a bunch of cGMP in this space? As all of this happens, the amount of cGMP starts going down. Initially, there's a lot of cGMP molecules in the cell, but the phosphodiesterase lowers its concentration just as if you pulled a plug out of a bathtub and the water level lowers. Now, there's a bunch of other stuff written in here, but I'm going to tell it to you. You see the sodium and calcium ions that come across this channel? When they do, it causes an imbalance of charge across this channel, which sends an electrical signal down this membrane, which goes down to the optic nerve, which sends it off to the brain, which interprets it. And you see. and I left out about six things. Here's what I want you to understand. The chemistry of allowing you to see is extremely complex. It's a cascade of reactions, each of which depends on the other one, that then finally allows you to have that imbalance of charge, which allows you to see. Now, here's the problem. If that's all that happened, ladies and gentlemen, you would be blind in 5 minutes. Now, why? Because you'd run out of this stuff. It would be out of balance. So I want to show you something. What I have talked to you about so far is just this forward reaction, which opens up. It closes the sodium channels and the calcium channels. It changes cGMP to 5GMP, and it's this forward reaction which allows vision to begin. But I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that within picoseconds, a reverse reaction begins to start replacing what you used up over here and to depolarize what was polarized. And if it didn't happen, you'd go blind. Now, do you see down here? I'm hoping some of you remember guanylate cyclase. I told you last night if a word ends in A-S-E, it is a protein. Yes, ma'am. It's a special kind of a protein called an enzyme. In your eye, there's a special enzyme. Let's go back here. It's guanylate cyclase, which helps the reverse reaction to start place, which replaces the cGMP, opens the channels, ups the sodium and calcium concentration, and gets you cycled back. And that's going on all the time in picoseconds, which is why you can see. Now, if Darwin were here today, here would be my question. Professor Darwin, can you explain to me how this complex interactive system, which all has to be present in order for it to work, came about by small steps adding up over long periods of time? It's like the story of the guy that jumped across the Grand Canyon. He says, oh, I leaped over in little steps, but none of the steps are there. It's a massive problem for an evolutionist at the biochemical level. Now, in this book, he looks at 8 different systems. We could look at 1,000. We don't have time to do that. This book covers 8. And here's a second one. It's blood clotting. You've seen this happen, haven't you? Maybe with your own knee. I had a sore like that after basketball one day. And over time, this isn't my knee, by the way. But here's what happens over time. Isn't that amazing? You need to go home this evening and thank God for blood clotting. Blood clotting is a phenomenal chemical reaction that has extremely important parameters. It must happen when it's needed, how long it's needed, and where it's needed. And if any of those is violated, you could have death. You know the 2 leading causes of death? Heart attacks and strokes. 2 of the leading causes. Both of those are caused by blood clots in the wrong place. I'm not talking about this very long. I just want to show you the process of clotting that takes place in your body looks like that. You got it? Here's what I want to show you about that. Here's the final enmeshed insoluble fibrin. That's the clot. How do you get there? Well, you have to first form soluble fibrin. And do you see these little Roman numerals here that are all along this place? Guess what those are, you people from last night? You already know the answer. They're proteins. There are 13 specific proteins to make all this happen. And this reaction is a cascade of reactions, each of which depends on the one before it, following down all the way till you finally get the enmeshed insoluble fibrin. If it didn't happen this way, ladies and gentlemen, you would clot to death. There's an intrinsic path and extrinsic path that both fall together here at this particular juncture and help you form that insoluble fibrin, which closes up the hole so you don't bleed to death. Amazing. What's a person called that doesn't clot well enough? A hemophiliac. The most common hemophiliacs among humans have one piece of this that doesn't work right. One little piece. If this piece right here doesn't function properly, the blood does not clot. What that's saying to us is you take out one piece of this cascade of reactions, nothing works. So again, I would ask Mr. Darwin, how is it that this complex system evolved with small steps over long periods of time to produce something so complex and interconnected that you have to have it all or it won't work? It's a big problem. Now, I must tell you, there's more to this story than this. Because if that's all that happened, ladies and gentlemen, you would continue to clot until you clotted yourself to death. So guess what? There's a reverse reaction that starts taking place that is also extremely complex that undoes the process so you don't have too much clotting. Now, I have one other thing to tell you this evening, and this is going to be fast. It deserves more attention. But I'll tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, you have a system built into you. Here's a picture of white blood cells entrapping a bacterial cell. They go after it, they attack it, and they kill it. Here's a cancer cell, and here are some T cells going after it. They're like the artillery coming after it. And here's what they do to it eventually. Here's the cancer cell after the T cells have sucked it dry, and this is what it ends up looking like. Worse for the wear. Your system is designed to attack enemies. It's called the immune system. Everybody knows about it. Here are the enemies. Whoops, pardon me. Here are the enemies over here, and when they attack your system, your body has 1, 2, 3 major systems to attack enemies. And kids, it's better than Star Wars. I'm staying in a room at the Malloy's house that's got Star Wars on the wall. Star Wars is nothing compared to this. So let me just explain briefly what happens here. This one I don't even have time to talk about. You see that helper T lymphocytes? I call those the Barnabas of the cell. Their job is to help the other guys do a better job. It's like they come along and say, "Come on, get the job done." They're chemical encouragers. So I'm not even talking about them. Let's go up here and talk about the humoral system up here at the top. Here's what happens. B lymphocytes, which are produced in your spine, mature into plasma cells, which start secreting antibodies, which float all over your system. And those antibodies are for the distinct purpose of identifying enemies. Let's blow that up just a little bit. Here's a B cell with the attached antibodies. Here comes the enemy. Ta-ta-da! And the antibodies attack it and start attaching to it. And once that happens, once the enemy is attached to this cell, you watch what happens. Here's what happens. The enemy is attached. Immediately, this cell starts changing into a plasma cell whose sole purpose is to produce antibodies just like the one you need for that enemy. Amazing. And it produces them at millions per second. Are you getting tired of hearing that? Things happen so quickly in our body, it's absolutely incredible. But here's another thing that happens. While that is taking place, this cell also produces what's called a memory cell. And I will tell you that the average lifetime of a B cell in your bloodstream is about 1.5 days. But once it's seen an enemy and starts building antibodies to attack that enemy, this memory cell that's formed stays in your body the rest of your life. That's why adults, ladies and gentlemen, can overcome illnesses better than children in many instances, because they've had experience. And here's how it works. This memory cell is patrolling through your bloodstream. If it ever sees that enemy again, he says, "Here it is, come get him." Amazing. There's a picture of an antibody. Here are the binding sites up here. This is where it attacks the enemy. Notice it has two heavy chains and two light chains that are connected together. And that whole process there is the antibody. Originally, the antibody is attached to the B cell so that it can get messages back and forth from the nucleus. But once that enemy is attached and this thing starts making antibodies, the antibodies are released into the bloodstream to go searching by the thousands. Amazing. Here's kind of how it works. Here's the stem cells, and they start producing automatically because they're directed by the DNA to make all different kinds of B cells, which are now going to be ready to attack enemies. You see that antibody right there? It can attack a certain kind of enemy. This antibody attacks another kind. And look, once it's attached, it starts making the antibody specifically for that enemy. This one makes it for this enemy. This one makes it for this enemy. But your body automatically produces hundreds of thousands of different ones. Boom! Like that. How does it do that? Very briefly. The antibody heavy chain can come from one out of 250 clusters in your DNA. And from another section, one out of 10 in cluster 2. One out of 6 in cluster 3. There can be recombination jiggles to give another factor of 100, which is 250 times 10 times 6 times 1,000 or 100 or 1,500,000 combinations of heavy chains that your body automatically can make. Little side trip here. You remember last night I told you we're starting to learn a whole lot more about DNA? This recombination jiggle stuff here happens because the DNA is being constructed and instructed to shift. And by shifting, you can make many more combinations. It's amazing. But that's just the heavy chains, ladies and gentlemen. How about the light chains? By the same process, the light chain yields about 10,000 different combinations. So if you're going to match one light chain with one heavy chain at random, that gives you 10,000 times 1,500,000 or 15 billion combinations. What that means is your body and its B cells automatically can produce 15 billion different chances to see the right enemy. I wonder how that happened in small steps over long periods of time. But I will tell you this. When this whole system is done, you know what you've accomplished? Identifying the enemy. There is! Now you got to kill him. How do you do that? Like that. Are you getting tired of this? Can you see that that is a whole cascade of reactions? Down here is where you kill him. You start here with a bound antibody, and then you start doing all these reactions that all depend on one another, and then boom, right here you kill him. It's called a complementary pathway. You're glazing over on me. You better be thankful your body's been doing that the whole time I've been talking. Now here's the T lymphocyte cell. This is the big artillery, guys. This is Star Wars. Look, if you aggravate a T lymphocyte cell, he matures into a cellular CTL. It's called a cytotoxic T lymphocyte. And if that thing gets a hold of a virus-infected cell, here's what happens. Kaboom! It is better than Star Wars. Don't mess with a T-cell. So we've looked at biochemistry of vision, we've looked at blood clotting, we've looked at the immune system, all of which are concepts of irreducible complexity. What do we mean by that? A system that requires it all or it doesn't work. And that's Behe's contribution. And it's a great one. Because evolutionists are in big trouble. So at the end of this book, here's an extensive quote I want to share with you because I love it. This is Michael Behe. These scientific obstacles serve as stark examples of the mountains and chasms that block a Darwinian explanation of life. Every one of them is a Grand Canyon. The result of these cumulative efforts to investigate the cell, to investigate life at the molecular level, is a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. The result is so unambiguous and so significant that it must be ranked as one of the greatest achievements in the history of science. The discovery rivals those of Newton and Einstein, Lavoisier and Schrodinger, Pasteur and Darwin. The observation that the intelligent design of life is as momentous as the observation that the Earth goes around the sun, or that disease is caused by bacteria, or that radiation is emitted in quanta. The magnitude of the victory gained at such great cost through sustained effort over the course of decades would be expected to send champagne corks flying in labs around the world. This triumph of science should evoke cries of Eureka from 10,000 throats, should occasion much hand-slapping and high-fiving and perhaps even an excuse to take the day off. I love it. But no bottles have been uncorked, no hands have been slapped. Instead, a curious, embarrassed silence surrounds the stark complexity of the cell. When the subject comes up in public, feet start to shuffle and breathing gets a bit labored. In private, people are a bit more relaxed. Many explicitly admit the obvious, stare at the ground, shake their heads, and let it go at that. So he says, why does the scientific community not greedily embrace this startling discovery? Why is the observation of design handled with intellectual gloves? Why can't people see this? That's his question. Then he gives this illustration. You're in this big empty room, and everybody's on the floor, looking around on the floor on his hands and knees, searching for something, and there's an elephant in the middle of the floor, and they don't even see it. And then he says, the dilemma is, while one side of the elephant may be labeled intelligent design, the other side might be labeled God. And we're not going to have that. Did I show you last night Francis Crick's book on life itself, in which he spent the last four chapters talking about how they sent first life here on a spaceship? For which there is zero evidence. We will take anything other than God. And I'm telling you, the evidence is so overwhelming, it's way bigger than an elephant. All of these things that I've shown you tonight are but illustrations of thousands that do not possibly lend themselves to small, successive changes over long periods of time, and thus Darwin's theory falls flat. I believe he would say that if he were here today. Anthony Flew said it, having been an atheist for 40 years. And I pray there'll be many others. I appreciated your prayer so much tonight that God will multiply the number of those. And that's my lesson tonight, as limited as it was. I do appreciate your good and careful attention in spite of the complexity of this subject, but I hope you're sharing with me in the wonder and the glory of God's creation. We started with Psalm 139. We are wonderfully and marvelously made, fearfully made, and that we know right well. May I say to you that in the 21st century, man has less excuse than ever for missing that there is a God and He is alive. In Him we live and we survive. We hope you'll also, having made that leap, make another one to investigate this book. Because by the same types of reasoning, you can examine this book and become convinced it too is a work of God Himself. And it contains the message of how God would have us to live in obedience to His will. Look, if He's powerful enough to create the things we've been talking about, wouldn't we want to submit to Him and do what He says? He says you need to submit to Jesus Christ our Lord, who gave His life for you. And Jesus says, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. If you're ready to make that step even tonight, we want to give you that opportunity while we stand and as we sing the song that's been selected.